Hey, everybody. Welcome. This is episode 90 of the Sound Off here on SCScoops.com for Sunday, November 22nd, 2009. I am the Solemn Monster here, sore throat and all, soldiering on. Have to do the 90th episode of the Sound Off, and it is a big one here. It is Survivor Series Sunday for WWE. I'm not going to talk too much about the pay-per-view because this is getting recorded later than I had hoped, and I'm sure by the time most of you listen to this, the Survivor Series will be a thing of the past. I'll give some predictions later on, but first things first here, got a lot to cover, and I want to go back, and I'm sure it's already old news by now, but I have an interesting live perspective to bring to Monday Night Raw from this past week. Of course, Raw emanated from the world's most famous arena, Madison Square Garden in New York City. This was, I believe, my 9th or 10th live Raw taping. I've lost track over the years, but it's always a fun time to be there live. And the one thing I will say about the so-called world's most famous arena, I can't think of too many arenas that have such a haphazard way of ushering people into the building. Anybody who's been to MSG, at least for a WWE show, I'm sure it's like this for other shows, knows that everyone just gets herded in like cattle, and you're just pressed up against someone else's flesh. You can barely breathe. You can barely move. It gets hot as hell. I think my face was pressed up against the spinner plate on somebody's WWE Championship replica belt. And I'm gonna get to that in a second. That's something else I have to rant on here this week, are these middle-aged guys that see fit to bring their championship belts to the building. So if you count yourself among those people, you might want to turn this show off. But anyway, and again, bear with me here. My voice at times may be a little on the low side. You'll just have to crank up your volume. My poor throat has not gotten any better. If anything, it's gotten worse over the last week. But, you know, going out until 2, 3 in the morning is not going to help. Anyway, Raw Monday night. Overall, my impressions, awesome show live. I've seen bits and pieces of the show, of the TV broadcast on YouTube, and it looks overall like it was a really, really fun show. I could tell you that live it was awesome. The crowd was hot all night long. Usually the Garden crowds are, but that's not universal. This was a show that everybody was up for almost everything, I think. And the one thing that the show did not accomplish, as fun as it was, if you want to look at it from a different point of view, as a show that was the go-home show to what was traditionally, or what is, I guess, traditionally one of the four big pay-per-view shows of the year, it was an utter failure. You know, it really didn't do much at all to convince people who were already on the fence to spend $40 on the Survivor Series. So in that respect, it was an epic fail. As a show itself, I had a great time. The first thing I noticed once I got into the building from our seats was the fact that there was no rampway and there was no Titantron. Now, I love this. I love that traditional short aisle Madison Square Garden arena setup. Traditionally, they'll only use it for pay-per-view events. You know, the WrestleMania 10, obviously, the 2000 Royal Rumble, the 2008 Royal Rumble last year, which I was also in attendance for. Those events jump to mind. There have been Raws from Madison Square Garden, and most of the time, those Raws, much like WrestleMania 20, do have the standard long aisleway and the giant screens. I was happy not to see it. I mean, it gave the show a very distinct look that I think they would, quite frankly, be best served to utilize more in the future at other buildings. Obviously, they've invested millions of dollars into that new HD set that they unveiled a year or two ago. They're not going to just throw it in the trash bin. But I think every now and then, when they come to a certain building that has a certain unique setup, kind of like MSG, it really does go a long way to give the show a fresh look. There's something to be said for the little things and giving the show a fresh look, and I think that's something they should do more of in the future. So I didn't mind not having the giant Titantron. There were other screens on top of the arena where we could watch what was going on, any video packages like that Empire State of Mind video, the MSG tribute, which was just awesome. All that was just great, great stuff. It was also a nice surprise. Before the show started, I literally turned to my friend who was inquiring about the whereabouts of Lillian Garcia, who, of course, is no longer with WWE. No sooner did I tell him that she would not be here tonight than Lillian Garcia is introduced. Obviously, she is a resident of New York City and was invited to the show, and she came out and did the national anthem, and it was great. Nobody does it better than Lillian. I've always been a big Howard Finkel fan, and I never thought Lillian was the best ring announcer, but nobody can deny her singing ability or her ability to put together an excellent rendition of the national anthem, and so that was great. Just a couple of other observations. We were sitting in section 120 of the garden, for those of you who are familiar with the building, where we were, you know, I attended the Royal Rumble last year with my brother, and we were sitting in section 220, so we were up in the mezzanine, kind of the middle mezzanine, and, you know, obviously they weren't ringside seats, but I thought our seats were really, really good. You don't really realize it until you go to the garden how small it kind of looks. I don't know what I was expecting, but when the building gets packed and it's filled, it looks somewhat small, even though I guess it really isn't. I thought our seats for the Rumble were really good, and so these seats were literally in the same section one level down. So my view of Raw on Monday night was virtually the same exact view I had of the action at the Rumble last year. So that short aisleway where all the wrestlers were coming out from, I couldn't see until they came all the way down the aisle because my seats were basically behind that and to the right. But that was fine. The one thing I will complain about, well, actually I'll complain about a lot of things, but seated next to us were three people, an older man, an older woman, and apparently their mother. We'll call her Granny. Granny could not have been under 75 years old. Granny was just so into the action. You've never seen a grandmother into the action on Monday Night Raw as much as you've seen with this woman. She had the John Cena You Can't See Me headband wrapped around her head. I was so concerned that it was squeezing her brains. She had the headband. She had a sign. In fact, she had multiple signs that she brought to the show. It would have sucked to be sitting behind her because she just did not give a shit about the people sitting behind her. Every 5 seconds, up with the sign, up with the sign. I thought Granny was going to be tossed off the mezzanine section down below, and that would have been entertaining. So while I appreciate the woman's enthusiasm, there's something seriously wrong with you when you're that age and you're that into WWE. But you know what? I've heard this before, and I guess there's some credence to this, that, you know, when you're younger and you're a child and even a baby, a little older, you're in diapers, you need people to look after you. And then you get older and you're a teenager, you're in your 20s, your 30s, adulthood sets in. And then if you're fortunate enough to make it into your later years, in your 60s, in your 70s, in your 80s, in your 90s, you kind of revert back to that old way of, you know, having people look after you and probably wearing diapers, a different kind of diaper, granted. But so in a way, when you're younger, you're a wrestling fan, and some people grow out of it, and some people, like us, don't. And when you get to a certain age where maybe your mind starts to go a little bit, you're getting up there in years, you almost revert back to the way things used to be. And maybe this person was a wrestling fan, you know, she used to watch matches with Frank Gotch, maybe, and George Hackenschmidt when she was a young lad, and now this poor woman is 80 years old, probably going out of her mind, she seemed a little off the wall, and damn it, you've never seen somebody more into the wrestling product than this woman. It's annoying to be sitting next to her when every 5 seconds she's screaming and chanting and cheering and ranting and raving, and you know, it's stadium-style seating, so nobody's view is really being blocked, again, unless you're holding up a sign, but yet, no matter what, in the row in front of us, okay, we were row B, so in row A, whenever somebody would get up to leave to go to the concession stands or would be walking by, this woman would just tear into them with such obscenities, you would think that a truck driver was sitting next to me. My father would appreciate that joke. So Granny, I won't say that Granny ruined the experience for me, but I was looking very early on, as good as our seats were, and they were pretty good seats for not being ringside, I was looking elsewhere at that point. Now, this ties into something that happened at the end of the show here. I mentioned on my Twitter page, cheap plug here, twitter.com/solomonster, that my night ended in depressing fashion, and I'll get to why in a second, but I know one of the security guards at Madison Square Garden because he does security for other sporting events, and I've met him through work functions. He's a great guy. We'll call him George, even though that's not his name. And I wanted to give George a call once I got to the garden just to let him know I was there. I haven't seen him since the summer, and I figured I know that he does security not for every single event at Madison Square Garden, but many of them, and he would probably like to know that I was there. I did not call him with the intention of trying to get better seats, because I didn't think he'd be able to get them for me anyway, and B, our seats were good enough. I'm happy enough with what I paid for. So I call George when I get to the building, and he doesn't answer. It goes to his voicemail. So I leave George a message saying that, hey, you know, I'm here, I just thought you might like to know. If you get this message, give me a call back, let me know where you are, I'll stop by and say hi. About 5 minutes later, maybe 10, we finally break through the crowd as we're coming into the building, and we get to the turnstiles, or whatever it was. There's a couple of security guys standing there, and there's George. George is standing right there. He sees me, I see him. I'm like, hey, what's going on? Your phone is off. He's like, yeah, yeah, my boss is here. I can't talk right now. I said, okay, I'll see you later. And I go about my merry way. Now, this is going to tie into something later on, so just I'm going to come back to this. But anyway, I have some other observations first. Roddy Piper was the guest host for Monday Night Raw. I thought it was a mistake. As entertained as I was by that opening skit, I thought it was a mistake to not just have Piper's music hit and have him come out to start the show. Because you'll notice when Piper came out later on for the segment with Vince McMahon, who got a massive pop, even live, the crowd reaction to Piper was subdued. That's the way it didn't just come across that way on TV. That's the way it was live. And I think that was in large part because we already saw Piper on screen once or twice earlier in the night, which killed the vibe a little bit. But he still got a very good reaction. It's great to see a Hall of Famer host these things and an actual wrestler and not some D-level celebrity for a change. I thought the Vince McMahon Roddy Piper segment was good stuff. It's the sort of, you know, I'm sure, I mean, look, the shows are all scripted out segment by segment, but these two guys went out there and they just did their thing and they spoke their own language, and it reminded me of promos and segments gone by from, you know, the Attitude Era and times like that. Vince McMahon, by the way, when he came out and got a huge pop, there were people, at least in my section and some of the sections around me, who were singing along to No Chance in Hell, which is one of my favorite wrestling themes, so that was cool stuff. I thought Vince completely owned Piper in that back and forth that they had, so that was interesting. And I pretty much knew that we were not going to get a Roddy Piper-Vince McMahon match. I was shocked by how many people around me were surprised when we got the bait and switch later on with Orton, but in my mind, I just figured there's no way they're just going to give this match away like this, and Vince is what? Vince is fully suited up. He's going to go backstage and get undressed into his wrestling gear in what? In 10 minutes? It's not going to happen. So that didn't bother me so much, and it didn't bother me in part because the bait and switch that we got was so awesome. And, of course, I'm talking about the Kofi Kingston-Randy Orton stuff. This was the highlight of the night, not just on TV, but in the arena. Kofi, now, I will say that at one point I thought, wow, this brawl has been going on for way too long, and they're just dragging this out longer than they should. But I actually, looking back on it, liked it, because it was hot at first, and then it cooled down because it just went on forever, and then the fans got right back into it. It was really, really interesting to hear the crowd. Of course, when Orton initially came out, there was a loud Randy Orton chant, and almost the moment Orton booted Piper in the gut, he turned the crowd against him. And it was a little embarrassing when he went for the punt and had to basically hold up because Kingston's music came on too late. That looked lame. But of course, they brawled into the crowd, then they brawled back to ringside, and then they brawled back into a different part of the crowd. Now, going back to the story about the security guard earlier, I had been doing some work this week, and actually that day, that involved media stuff, and I did not want to answer my phone during the event. I didn't want to turn the phone off, because I was doing some live Twittering until Twitter stopped working on my phone. But I didn't want to turn my phone off, but it was on. It was on vibrate. And I felt my phone vibrate. About midway through the event, I felt my phone start vibrating. And I didn't want to answer it. I looked at the display, and it said private number. Now, my phone, my BlackBerry, will say private number when I get a call either from home, because I know our listings are hidden, or if it's from, occasionally, a media outlet. So, I did not answer the phone. George, the security guard I mentioned earlier, I have his cell number, and it's programmed into my phone. Had I seen his name pop up on my display, I would have answered the phone in a heartbeat, but again, it's a private number, and so I assume, shit, this is probably media calling, and I'm off duty, I don't want to answer that call. My phone must have rang another 8 or 9 times. Now I'm concerned. Because now I'm thinking, what if it is a call from home? What if something's wrong? What if something happened? And this is so horrible to say, but I was so adamant that this experience was going to be a fun time and nothing was going to ruin this for me that even the prospect of a family emergency was not enough to get me to answer the phone. I figured, you know what? There's about half an hour left in the show. What is the difference if I answer my phone now or in half an hour? I'm in the middle of Madison Square Garden with a legit 20,000 people. What good could I possibly be to anybody? So I didn't answer the phone. So the Orton-Kingston brawl takes place. Awesome fucking stuff. Kofi Kingston, his name is being chanted. He looks like a bona fide star. Just really, really awesome stuff. Now it's time for the main event. Now, it's worth noting that when DX came out, much like Piper earlier, their reaction was somewhat subdued because we had already seen DX earlier in the night. And I can tell you that when they pedigreed Hornswoggle, everybody in the crowd was confused. There were cheers, there were boos, there was silence, there were oohs, there were ahs. I didn't know what to make of it myself. For a brief split second there, I thought, shit, I just witnessed DX turning heel. And then I realized that was not the case. But it was interesting. I still don't quite know what to make of that. I'm assuming that there is a long-term angle to this, that maybe Hornswoggle is going to go heel, and maybe he'll interfere even in the championship match tonight and cost DX the championship. Whatever the plan may be, but that was interesting. So DX comes out, and Jericho and Big Show come out. Undertaker and John Cena come out. John Cena booed all night. Anytime he was shown on the screen, his hokey promo, any of the videos they showed between commercials, they booed him mercilessly, and they booed him again when he came out. Then The Undertaker comes out, and this was really cool stuff. Because we got a pay-per-view-like entrance for The Undertaker with the druids and the flaming torches and the lightning and the flickering, and there really is nothing like an Undertaker entrance when you experience it live. So I was looking forward more to the entrances than I was the actual match being there in Madison Square Garden. And I realized also that we were not in for a terribly long main event, given that it was starting at like 11:07. But we still got a solid 6 or 7 minutes, and John Cena pins Triple H. Undertaker gives Cena the Tombstone Piledriver, which I thought was interesting, and I subsequently have read online that apparently the current plan for WrestleMania 26 is for a John Cena-Undertaker match, which is infinitely better than a Vince McMahon-Undertaker match. And actually, a match that I myself, on this very podcast in the past, have talked about the fact that I think John Cena would be a great opponent for The Undertaker at WrestleMania, because I don't believe that Undertaker's streak is going to come to an end. And it certainly is not going to come to an end to John Cena, because if The Undertaker's streak was to come to an end, it would have to be against somebody that could benefit from it, a young guy or whoever. John Cena stands to benefit and gain nothing from it. John Cena is already a main event star. He doesn't even need to be a champion. He's reached that level to where it would mean nothing to him. It serves no purpose to end the streak to somebody like John Cena. But how many people, how many of you listening to this show would buy into the fact that John Cena could very well beat The Undertaker because he's Superman? John Cena always overcomes the odds. And just imagine those near falls in that match. I think if they stick to that plan, that's a phenomenal match for The Undertaker to have. And it also means, most likely, that it will not be a championship match. But again, Vince McMahon will likely change his mind a million times between now and then. I think if that's the direction they're going in, it's a great match. So the main event is over now, and it was a lot of fun. DX brought a handicapped kid into the ring at the end to do some DX crotch chops, and that was pretty much it. A really fun show. So now I leave Madison Square Garden. Now to the fun part of the story here. I walk out of Madison Square Garden, and I got all different types of thoughts running through my head. I can just imagine who was calling my phone and why they saw fit to call my phone 9 times. I also noticed that I had 2 voicemail messages on my phone, and now I'm thinking the worst. I'm thinking, oh my God, something happened to my mother. Something happened that is just going to make me feel so awful. And oh yes, something was about to make me feel quite awful. It was a message, actually multiple messages, from George, the security guard. Apparently he tried calling me earlier in the show, about midway through, to tell me to immediately come down with my friend to the opposite side of the arena, to section 51, by the catwalk. And I'm thinking to myself, where is that? And I came home that night, and I went onto the Ticketmaster website, and I brought up the WWE map for Madison Square Garden. And sure enough, section 51 is directly opposite where I was on the other side of the arena, which would have given me a full-on view of the aisle, but more importantly than that, it is the exact area. And you'll notice this if you go back and watch the segment on TV. The area where Kofi Kingston and Randy Orton brawled, just before, it was the area where Kingston did his dive onto Orton through the table. There is a section right behind Kofi where they were brawling and where Kofi did his jump that was mostly empty. And the reason they kept those seats empty were for some of the security guards. You know, in the event that somebody needed to be moved there, you know, if the seats weren't occupied, then they would fill them with whoever. Apparently George wanted to move me and my friend to that section, and so I passed on the opportunity, essentially, to be sitting right there when the Randy Orton-Kofi Kingston brawl came to its frenzied climax. And I was so pissed. I wanted to just throw myself in front of a New York City taxi cab at that point. Not just because it would have been phenomenally awesome to be sitting right there and be able to witness what essentially was the best segment on the entire show, live. You know, forget about getting on TV. That's less important to me. But just to be able to have been there, and more importantly even than that, to be able to move away from the crazy granny that was sitting next to me, I was just heartbroken at that point. But again, it's one of those things that you can't help but laugh. I mean, I could look back on it now and laugh. I mean, look, I had a great time. Our seats were still pretty good. And it's really nobody's fault but my own. And I had to call him the next day because I felt bad that he called me 8 times and I basically ignored him and I had to explain why and called me a fucking idiot. And I said, yeah, you're right. I am a fucking idiot. This will certainly not happen again next time. I told him, I said, look, next time I come here, you're gonna get a call from me and I'm going to be glued to my phone all night long. But it's just funny. My own stupidity is why that happened. But yeah, I could have been sitting right there for the Randy Orton, Kofi Kingston brawl, and for what really was Kofi's coming out moment, in my opinion, of this feud. This is the one, the real star-making moment for him. If they follow up on this properly, Kofi could be a main eventer. I'll go ahead and say it. But the key is the follow-up. We've seen this start and stop push with so many different guys that I'm not confident that WWE can follow through properly, but so far they've done a fantastic job. And Kofi standing up on that barricade after he put Orton through a table with the entire arena on its feet, Madison Square Garden chanting his name, is probably the biggest moment of his career to this point. And it was just really, really good stuff. And yeah, too bad I couldn't be sitting front and center for it, but that's what happens when you don't answer your phone. So let that be a lesson to all of you in the future. And by the way, I did ask him about that. I said, you know, I had your cell phone in my BlackBerry. Why would your name not come up? And he explained that he was calling me from a work phone, you know, a work cell. And in fact, in the voicemail message, he said, look, you can't call me back. Don't call me back. Just come down to Section 51. So obviously that never happened, but that would explain why his name did not come up in my phone. Now, just to rant on one other thing that, again, I kind of teased earlier. You know, one thing I noticed when I was coming into the garden and when I was looking around at the crowd, I'm sure it's like this at most arenas, it's not just a New York thing, were the unbelievable number of men in their 20s, in their 30s, even in their 40s, walking around with gigantic replica championship belts over their shoulder. Now, look, I'll be the first to admit, I myself own a replica championship belt. Granted, I bought it 8 years ago when they first started making them. And it hangs gloriously from my wall. It is the Big Eagle world belt from from WWF from like 2000, 2001. Looks great. Great showpiece. One thing you will never ever see me doing is walking around with the belt over my shoulder. Now, I'm almost positive that there are some people listening to this podcast that do this sort of thing or have done it before. And look, it's a free country. You can do whatever you want. I'm just telling you, when you're of a certain age, late 20s, 30s, 40s, you look ridiculous walking around with a championship belt over your shoulder. If you bought the belt at the show, fine. But if you brought the belt from home, if you're on the subway with the belt, if you're on the bus with the belt, you look ridiculous. I bumped into so many people with belts on their shoulders. I even got a cut on my forearm from one of the bolts on one of the belts when I brushed up against somebody. And they, you know, these people, they walk around, and I say to myself, why? Is that supposed to impress me? Is that supposed to impress somebody? Are you going to challenge somebody for the championship? Why lug that thing? These things are huge. They're heavy. Why would you bring them to the show? It doesn't make any sense to me. It really doesn't. I walked around with a Jack's Pacific Foam replica of the spinner belt on Halloween. You know why? Because it was Halloween. Because I knew when I went out that I was going to make a jackass out of myself. This was not Halloween. This was a normal night in mid-November at Madison Square Garden. And I can't tell you how many people in their 30s were walking around with these belts on their shoulders. It's pathetic. Please don't do that anymore. Please don't do that. I love belts. I'm a belt collector myself. But you'll never, ever see me walking around with it, let alone even at a wrestling show. It's not, it doesn't work. If you're in your teens, fine. When you're 35 years old, you shouldn't be walking around with a championship belt over your shoulder. Stop. Anyway, that's my sound off on that stuff. I'm sure that'll piss some people off, but hey, it's my show. That's how I feel. As I mentioned earlier, Survivor Series is tonight, so no point really in me going through the whole card or talking too much about it. Just to give some quick predictions, I don't see Undertaker dropping the title tonight, so I would predict that Undertaker would retain his World Heavyweight title against Chris Jericho in the Big Show. The WWE Championship match is a little harder to call. Again, it wouldn't shock me if Hornswoggle got involved in some way and caused DX the match. Otherwise, I don't see what the fucking point is of this month-long deal with Hornswoggle and DX. But I'm just going to go ahead and say that John Cena will retain the title. Of the two members of DX, there's no way Shawn Michaels wins the championship. If anything, I could see Triple H going heel and winning the belt. I just think this has been played up for way too much comedy that at some point in this match, you know, somebody has to do something. Triple H has done promos in the past about how he lives and he eats and he sleeps and he breathes to be the champion. And, you know, judging by the last couple of weeks of buildup, it's almost just incidental that he happens to have a title match. You know, Triple H on Raw talking about the fact that he doesn't care who wins the championship as long as it's one member of DX goes completely counter to the Triple H character. Triple H doesn't want anybody but himself to be the champion. He will do anything it takes to be the World Heavyweight Champion. Why that all of a sudden has changed, why his priorities have shifted, I don't quite know. But it makes me think that perhaps there could be something going down tonight. But I'm going to go ahead and pick Cena to retain the title. Batista and Rey Mysterio. I'm just going to go with Batista just destroying Mysterio. I know Mysterio has some really serious knee problems. He might even have a bone-on-bone problem in one of his knees. Some people have even talked about the fact that it could be a career-threatening injury. From what I understand, Rey is going to, you know, this is not a program that is designed to go one pay-per-view match and be done. This is designed to go a couple of months, and Rey is committed to finishing this feud out, so they could do an injury angle where Dave just destroys Rey. I think ultimately we'll see that. But if Rey is going to keep going for another 2 or 3 months, tonight's not the night for that to happen then. So hard to say then. You know, maybe Rey wins this first match and then Dave comes back and injures him. I'm just going to go with Batista. I know it's Batista's hometown, and we all know that when somebody's in their hometown, with very few exceptions, usually things do not go their way. I know there have been exceptions. You know, Trish Stratus won the women's championship and retired in Toronto at a pay-per-view, Unforgiven, a couple of years ago. So there are exceptions, but I'll go with Big Dave in this match. A couple of Survivor Series matches, that's always fun. I don't see Kofi Kingston winning his match. You know, the way I see this going down is perhaps Kofi is the last man standing on his team up against three or four members of Randy Orton's team, but ultimately Orton wins with an RKO after Kofi fights valiantly. Orton needs some of his heat back, and that would be the way to do it, and then they can build to a singles match on pay-per-view between the two of them. That's how I would do it. So I would say Orton wins the match for his team. A couple of other matches, but like I said, I'm not going to go into all of that. If you're watching the show, enjoy it, have fun, let me know your thoughts, and I'm sure there'll be plenty to talk about next week about the Survivor Series. Although, one interesting little nugget here that I realized, you know, Survivor Series once upon a time used to be the Thanksgiving Day tradition, and then it became the Thanksgiving Eve tradition. Now it's usually the Sunday before Thanksgiving Day tradition. There's another Survivor Series tradition that I realized, and that is the tradition of Triple H being involved in a championship main event match at Survivor Series, because it was 10 years ago, at the 1999 Survivor Series, which I believe was in Detroit, that Triple H was in the championship triple threat main event match, much as he is tonight. Some things never change. You've got Triple H, of course, back in 99, defended his title in a triple threat against The Rock and The Big Show. It was supposed to be Stone Cold Steve Austin, but Stone Cold had been run down by the dastardly Rikishi earlier in the night. And Triple H dropped the belt to The Big Show, won it back a couple of weeks later. Perhaps Triple H will have more success tonight. I guess we'll find out. But like I said, some things never change. It's just funny. You know, 10 years later, here we are again, and there's Triple H in another triple threat main event title match at the Survivor Series. I want to shift over to TNA here for a little bit. This will satisfy all the TNA fans. I did check out the top matches at their Turning Point pay-per-view. And I can't vouch for the rest of the show, but what I saw was awesome. Kurt Angle and Desmond Wolfe. I mean, let's be honest here. When Nigel McGuinness first signed with TNA, the prospects of a Nigel-Kurt Angle match were just phenomenal. And they certainly lived up to expectations. It was a great match. The main event, Joe, Daniels, AJ, really, really good stuff. I can't say whether it was better than their match from 4 or 5 years ago because I don't remember seeing that match. But it was just great stuff. And AJ goes over, remains the TNA champion for now. And TNA got a thumbs-up effort on pay-per-view, which is rare. It's probably the best TNA pay-per-view show of the year, judging based on people's feedback and just based on what I saw. So, two thumbs way up for TNA on Turning Point. Now, on the flip side here, it's time to bash TNA. Because every time TNA takes one step forward, they seem to take two steps back. For all the praise people have heaped on them for Turning Point, and I was the first one here to say that I loved it too. You look at the Impact spoilers, and just a little FYI here, I am going to be giving some Impact spoilers here, so, about the Thanksgiving Day show. So if you don't want to hear this, you might want to skip over this part. But apparently TNA has some sort of tournament that they are doing. And this will be, I believe this is airing this coming Thursday night on Spike TV. So it's basically, instead of a turkey bowl, they're doing a championship series with the winner getting a shot at the respective title in their division. So for example, if you primarily wrestle tag matches, you would get a tag team title shot, and so on and so forth. Now, it's worth noting that at Turning Point, Scott Steiner defeated Bobby Lashley. In fact, Scott Steiner pretty much beat him clean. I know it wasn't totally clean, but he basically pinned him 1-2-3. And that made a lot of people think, including myself, that Bobby Lashley is on his way out of TNA. Because Bobby Lashley has been in the process of making some pretty big decisions in his life, whether or not he's going to stay in TNA and continue to wrestle, or sign with an organization in MMA like Strikeforce and devote his entire career to mixed martial arts, which I think is ultimately what he is going to do. His goal is to get into UFC, but I think there's a better chance of him getting into the Strikeforce organization before that. And Bobby, I don't think, has made a decision yet. Bobby may well be on his way out of TNA. And so Scott Steiner beating him essentially clean on pay-per-view, to me, seemed to indicate that they either thought Bobby was going to leave or they knew that he was going to be leaving. And so why put him over one of their talents if he's going to be on his way out? Okay, makes sense. Fast forward to the Impact tapings. Again, this is for the upcoming Thanksgiving Day episode. Bobby Lashley is involved in a tournament to determine the number one contender for the TNA World title, essentially, because that's what Bobby would be competing for. And I look at the brackets for the tournament, and nowhere in the brackets do I see Scott Steiner, the man who beat him clean, 1-2-3, on the pay-per-view that it just concluded, is not even involved in the tournament for a potential title opportunity. But Bobby Lashley is in the tournament. Okay, fine. Bobby Lashley battles Abyss. He beats Abyss. Bobby Lashley battles Desmond Wolfe. He beats Desmond Wolfe. Why does he beat Desmond Wolfe, by the way, is even better. Desmond Wolfe apparently refused to break the ropes, and the referee disqualified him. Desmond Wolfe, who has been in this business for how many years now, and is fighting for a championship match, refuses to break the ropes and gets himself disqualified. Desmond Wolfe is a fucking moron. He has shit for brains. So Bobby Lashley advances, and Bobby Lashley beats Robert Roode in the finals to earn himself a title shot. Yes, the man who lost clean to Scott Steiner at the pay-per-view just won a tournament on Impact to get a title shot. When Scott Steiner, the man who beat him, doesn't even get a spot in the tournament. Way to go, Vince Russo. Way to go. It really is a situation where with TNA, you know, one step forward, two steps back all the time. This feast or fired match, perhaps the dumbest match I've ever heard of in my life. You know, Vince Russo loves his poles. I'm sure he'll have 5 or 6 poles surrounding the ring in this match. That's coming up on the Final Resolution pay-per-view on December 20th. Just the dumbest shit that you've ever heard of in your entire life. And like I said, Vince Russo, I hope to God that when Hulk Hogan comes in, and again, January 4th, it's looking like it'll be Hulk's first date. I hope to God that when Hulk comes in, it does not take long for him to give Vince Russo the boot, because the sooner they can get rid of Vince Russo, I don't give a shit if Hulk Hogan brings in Brutus Beefcake and the Nasty Boys with him. The sooner they can give the boot, the big boot, if you will, to Vince Russo, the better off this company is going to be. The talent they have is maybe collectively better than the talent WWE has. The tools are there for TNA to make that next big leap and do big things, but as long as they have a fucking moron writing their TV shows, an ADD fucking moron writing their TV shows, they're not going to go anywhere. They will go absolutely nowhere. They will draw their 1.1s, and they'll be happy, and Dixie will give a stupid speech every now and then, and that'll be the end of it. Get rid of this man. Get rid of Vince Russo, and get rid of him now. Why don't they understand that? Why are we the only ones? Jim Cornette, smart people in the business. I'm not even in the business. There are smart people in the business who know this. Why does Dixie Carter and TNA not realize this? Why do they insist on giving this man chance after chance to book their TV show and run their company? Why? Can somebody please explain that to me? Why? If Dixie is listening, please, Dixie, baby, call me, email me, let me know. I'm just dying to know the answer. Speaking of Hulk Hogan, Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair had a press conference, in case you hadn't heard about this, a couple of days ago down in Australia, hyping the Hulkamania tour, and they got worldwide press out of what was such a simple angle. It's such a beautiful thing, and I give Hogan and Flair all the credit in the world. Clearly, it was a staged press conference. Ric Flair gave Hulk a pretty weak slap. Somehow, Hulk Hogan got busted open, bleeding like a pig all over the place, wearing a white shirt, no less. The guy is awesome. It's just another reason to love Hulk Hogan as a worker. People don't give him enough credit. Obviously, he can barely move these days. He was never the greatest in-ring wrestler in the world, but the guy knows the basics. And this incident that took place at this press conference down in Australia literally garnered worldwide attention. It's just amazing. Here in the U.S., TMZ.com, in England, in Australia, all over the world. And the thing about Australia that was kind of embarrassing is the way they covered it. They covered it as a shoot. They actually were talking about it as though it was a legitimate incident. Things went wrong. Ric Flair snapped and beat up Hulk Hogan, who bled at a press conference. It's just unbelievable that Kayfabe does live in some parts of the world in 2009. It's actually somewhat refreshing to see, but these were mainstream Australian news outlets. So if you live in Australia, you gotta just shake your head at that. I mean, it's embarrassing that they would even treat it as though it could have. You know, there were some outlets that openly speculated, well, perhaps it was a work, but it certainly seemed real enough. I mean, that would be the equivalent of, like, an ABC News reporter here in this country covering one of those ridiculous WrestleMania press conferences where you really don't even have any press people. And, you know, if Donald Trump was there and he slapped Vince McMahon in the face, treating it as though it was a shoot, you know, and maybe Vince will sue Donald Trump now. I mean, it's just comical. But kudos to Hogan and Flair. They got the job done. They may have even sold some extra tickets doing it. As of this recording, they've already had the first show down in Australia. They have three more to go, I believe. The one last night was, you know, mixed reports. Some people said it was fun. Some people said it was pathetic. Hogan at least, took virtually no bumps. It was the easiest, safest possible match he could work. Both men bled like there was no tomorrow. And of note is the fact that there was no leg drop. Hogan wasn't lying when he said that he couldn't do the leg drop anymore. He can't do it. He's got a bad back. He's got an artificial hip, I think, or an artificial knee. He may not be able to do the leg drop anymore. I think Flair had some brass knucks that were thrown at him by Lacey Von Erich, who signed up for the tour before she joined TNA, so she was allowed to do the Hulkamania tour. And I think Hulk got a hold of the brass knucks, hit Flair with them, and pinned him 1-2-3. So certainly the outcome of that match, and of all their matches on this tour, should be no surprise. But Hogan got through the first one pretty safe. He's got three more to go. And if you're down in Australia, if you're a listener of the Sound Off and you've been to any of these shows, definitely send in your thoughts, and I'll be sure to include them in the mailbag next week. So there you go. That's your news on the Hulkamania tour. That's all the main news this week. Nothing terribly new on the Brock Lesnar situation. Things may not be as dire as originally thought, but he's still in pretty bad shape. He just had some minor intestinal surgery a couple of days ago, so he is recuperating as we speak. But no major breaking news on whether or not his fighting career will resume. If it does, again, it's not going to be for many, 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 many months. But certainly all the best to Brock. It would be a shame if he couldn't do what he likes to do and what he does best. I mean, this is his livelihood, and let's just hope that UFC has not seen the last Brock Lesnar main event on one of their pay-per-views. So, on that note, we've got some mailbag questions here to get to, so I'm going to bring this giant mailbag sack that I have sitting next to me, of course, with all of your emails, and we'll get to some questions right here. All right, let's see here. Dear Solomonster, do you think wrestling organizations should start using the wrestlers' actual heights and weights instead of exaggerating them? I don't even mind rounding up the numbers. So, for example, somebody who's 6'1.5" could be 6'2", or who weighs 227 could weigh 230. But in my opinion, some of the gross exaggerations are a flat-out insult to the fans' intelligence. Well, yeah, of course they should, but they won't. So it's not even worth the frustration. It's as I said in the email, it's been a practice in the wrestling business for decades, the exaggerations. I agree, some of the exaggerations, I mean, they're just ridiculous. Big Show's weight, and in fairness, Big Show's weight really has fluctuated over the last 10 to 12 years. But it's just comical how one week he'll come out at, you know, a slim 450, now he's back up to 500 pounds. What is he? Is he 450? Is he 500? Is he somewhere in the middle? It's really not worth getting too frustrated over. It's just something that WWE and TNA and probably even some indie organizations, they do it quite often, and it's not something that's going to stop anytime soon. So no sense in worrying about that. Got some questions from my boy Howard here. I answered him directly, but I think it's worth bringing up here. He had two questions. There were some people he had in mind that he thinks about and wonders if they would fit into the WWE Hall of Fame criteria, with the understanding that, of course, there may, in fact, be no clear-cut criteria other than what side of the bed Vince McMahon wakes up on that morning. Regarding the following people, my thoughts on them as potential future Hall of Famers: Michael Cole, Taz, Percy Pringle, Lillian Garcia, Mark Henry, and Goldust. Howard thinks a case can be made for most of those people if we are assuming a case was made for Coco Beware. Well, taking them one by one, Michael Cole, as I said, does not deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. And in fact, Michael Cole should be taken off TV immediately. It's worth noting that Michael Cole has a lot of heat right now in WWE. People think that people behind the scenes, people who actually matter, thinking that he's been dogging it, he does what he wants, he's made a couple of mistakes, more so recently than he should. So Michael Cole has a lot of heat. That doesn't mean he's going to be removed from Raw in the next, you know, couple of weeks. But he is definitely not the sweetheart of Vince McMahon right now backstage. But Michael Cole does not deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. You know, there are very few managers and announcers that have, in my opinion, earned that distinction. Mean Gene Okerlund is in the Hall of Fame because he belongs there. Mean Gene Okerlund went from the AWA to the WWF to WCW, back to the WWF. He is an iconic figure in the wrestling industry and has interviewed some of the biggest names of all time, including Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair. He had his own hotline for many years. He's become a character really all unto himself. And so, him being in the Hall of Fame is absolutely worthy. Having a Gordon Solie in the Hall of Fame is worthy. Having a Jim Ross in the Hall of Fame is worthy. But just because you're an announcer for 10 years or 12 years doesn't entitle you to become a member of the Hall of Fame. Michael Cole has done nothing to earn any recognition as a Hall of Famer in the wrestling industry. He may be a fine news announcer and a news broadcaster, as he was many, many, many years ago before he even got into the WWF. But as far as being a WWE Hall of Famer, not now, not ever. Taz won't go in as long as he is with TNA. The same can be said for Mick Foley and for Sting. But I think Taz has enough credentials to go in at some point. He was an ECW champion in the original organization. His WWF debut at the Royal Rumble at MSG to this day is still one of the more memorable debuts, I think, in the history of the company. And successful ones at that. Of course, it all went downhill from there. But Taz is also, he has the distinction of having done something that has never been done and will never be done again. And, of course, I'm talking about back in 2000 when there was that very interesting situation where he went back to ECW while he was under WWF contract for a match against Mike Awesome. The story there was Mike Awesome was the ECW champion in the original ECW. He, I guess, much like many of the workers back then working for Paul Heyman, had one too many checks bounced, wasn't getting paid, and decided that he was going to take a better deal with WCW. But now he was still the ECW champion. He had a lot of heat in the locker room by people who thought that he stabbed the company in the back when, you know, in reality, Austin didn't really do anything wrong. But there were a lot of people who were not very happy with him. And so Vince McMahon and Taz and Heyman and WWF, they all came to this understanding, this agreement that they would have Taz, a WWF superstar, defeat Mike Awesome, who was now technically a WCW contracted wrestler, at an ECW event for the ECW World Heavyweight Championship. And Taz won the belt, of course, and that was one of the more memorable scenarios that I could ever think of involving multiple organizations. I mean, even though WCW wasn't directly involved, Awesome was a WCW talent officially at that point, at least in contract terms. So, anyway, Taz is, he has a lot of accomplishments under his belt. He molded himself and was molded, and I'll give Michael Cole credit on this because Michael Cole was Taz's main broadcast partner for many years, and Michael Cole taught Taz a lot, and they became very good friends, and I'll give Cole credit for that. But Taz became a great color commentator, and he's brought a lot, I think, even to TNA Impact in the few months now that he has been there. So, yeah, when guys like Nikolai Volkoff and Coco Beware are in the Hall of Fame, I don't see why you wouldn't put somebody like Taz in there at some point. Lillian Garcia doesn't deserve it. I'm sorry. Mark Henry doesn't deserve it. Goldust is an interesting one. You know, Goldust was never a world champion anywhere that he was. Not in the NWA, WCW, WWF, TNA. He's undergone a lot of different character transformations, which is usually the kiss of death. I mean, if you're successful under one character, usually stick with it. And Goldust has had his ups and downs. But He is a former three-time Intercontinental Champion. I believe he was a tag team champion as well. And the Goldust character, at least in its original incarnation, was so unique and so controversial and risque. But he made it work. You know, Dustin Runnels made it work. He pulled it off. And to this day now, he's reverted back to playing the Goldust character, and he's helping the younger guys on the ECW brand working with them. And so, could Goldust be in the Hall of Fame? I think Goldust is one of those guys that, he's one of those mid-card guys that you're on the fence about, and it could go either way. And if you gave me a vote, does Goldust deserve a spot in the WWF Hall of Fame? My answer would be yes. And again, I take in part the argument that if somebody like Coco Beware and Nikolai Volkoff, who also were mid-carders, who were never world champions, and in some cases they weren't even intercontinental champions. I mean, at least Goldust held the secondary title on three different occasions. Then I absolutely think that Dustin, as Goldust, as the Goldust character, not Dustin Runnels, but Goldust, deserves a spot at some point in the WWF Hall of Fame. Absolutely. You know, he's also a fine in-ring performer with a pedigree in this business, of course, being the son of Dusty Rhodes. But, you know, just being the son of Dusty Rhodes is not what would get him in. I think his talents and his success as the Goldust character, at least in the early part of his career as Goldust, I think entitles him to a spot. Absolutely. Let's see here. Dear Solomon Monster, do you find it ironic that Mick Foley appeared on the recent edition of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart just after a segment in concerning the selling of the Pontiac Silverdome? So a little background here. There's a story this past week that the Pontiac Silverdome in Pontiac, Michigan, the site, of course, of the most famous WrestleMania of all time, WrestleMania 3, which drew either 93,178 fans or 78,000 fans, depending on who you believe. I think the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle, but the Pontiac Silverdome has been sold. Originally, it was going to be sold for several million dollars, and that didn't happen, and so it was put back on sale, and it was bought for, I believe, a grand sum of $500,000. It was, excuse me, somewhere between $500,000 and $600,000 for the Pontiac Silverdome. Unbelievable. And there are people saying, well, how come WWF didn't swoop in, and or WWE, rather, didn't swoop in and buy the Pontiac Silverdome? They have such history in that building, that one event. They have such history there. And that's actually part of the question here from this this listener, considering how much we found out recently that the McMahon family owns with respect to their finances, the money they have, should they have bought that property in Michigan? No, you know, because sure, they could afford the initial asking price. They could offer, let's say, $550,000 and buy the Silver Dome, but there's probably renovations involved. There's a lot of other fees that are involved. They're not just going to buy the building and let it sit there and then, you know, voila. There's a lot more to it than that. WWE has been in cost-cutting mode now for quite some time, and so even though it sounds like a drop in the bucket, it's still $500,000 that would probably end up morphing into over $1 million or more if renovations were made. God, my throat is killing me. So there's a lot more expense involved than just that. I do like the idea that the writer brings up about perhaps it would make for a good place for a WWE museum or an official Hall of Fame complex. I don't know that that's the right market for it. I think if they ever did something like that, they'd want to do it in New York, or California, or Stamford, where their headquarters are located. You know, Detroit, Michigan, or Pontiac, Michigan, whatever it is it's kind of an obscure location, that probably isn't conducive to having too many tourists and visitors go there. I'm sure it would help the local economy, especially in Michigan. I mean, there are parts of Michigan like Flint, Michigan, and Detroit that are just, they've been devastated by the economy in the last couple of years in terms of unemployment and things of that nature. The idea of that does make sense. Sure, buy the Pontiac Silverdome. What a fantastically historical site for your Hall of Fame. In practice, it doesn't work. It's not the right place for it, and so I don't blame them for not buying it. It's not a matter of whether or not they can afford it. They're in cost-cutting mode. You're not just going to buy up a building, you know, no matter how much it costs. It just doesn't make any sense. The writer also wants to know, when do I think there'll be another edition of SE Scoops Live with Noah Mark? I don't know when there's going to be another edition of SE Scoops Live. If we do another one, which is always a question of if, not when, I would guess it would probably be probably sometime after the Royal Rumble in January, or I guess February, since the Rumble, I think, is on January 31st, so that would be February 1st. But, yeah, that might be the next possible time for that. We try to do a couple of shows per year. It just doesn't work for me schedule-wise, and so that's why we don't do it every week. Plus, the product had gotten so bad that, you know, we only had so much to talk about. We can only do so much complaining about the show every week before it gets old. And then we were having technical issues with Blog Talk Radio and all that. I would say me and Noah, we've had loose discussions about it. I've talked to him actually quite a bit in the last week or two. He was texting me during Raw last Monday, and apparently he attended a live NASCAR race last night because he kept texting me photos from the pit. And Kyle Busch, who of course was a recent co-host or guest host for Monday Night Raw, and he was right there in the pit, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, I had no idea he was even... he was even going to the race, but apparently Noah he's all over the place. So we'll see. We might do one after the Rumble, but I'd be lying if I told you that we were definitely going to do one then. So it's just a matter of wait and see. But, I think the next one would likely not be until 2010 at some point. Back to the question. I almost forgot to answer the original question that the writer posed. Do I find it ironic? I can't believe I forgot the question. Do I find it ironic that Mick Foley appeared on The Daily Show right after a segment concerning the Pontiac Silverdome? No, I don't see... No, there's... one doesn't have anything to do with the other. So the Pontiac Silverdome had WrestleMania 3. What does that have to do with Mick Foley? They're two totally different things. I will say, Mick Foley, I saw his segment on The Daily Show. Really funny stuff. If you didn't see it, you could find it online. It's basically for comedy. There was a legitimate news story that Jon Stewart was talking about. This young kid... excuse me, refuses to stand up and honor the Pledge of Allegiance at his school until the United States offers, I think, equal rights for homosexuals or something to that effect. Really very articulate, very smart young kid who's being ridiculed for his beliefs at school unfairly. And so Jon Stewart calls Mick Foley live into the studio, who proceeds to cut an awesome promo on anybody who dare bother this young child. And meanwhile, in the background, Jon Stewart is basically got the feather boa and the cane. He's like a mix of Jesse Ventura and Classy Fred Blassie as Foley's manager, and really funny stuff. So if you could find the segment online, I would advise you to check it out. Dear Solomonster, an interesting piece of information for you. Did you know that WWE programming in the UK, shown on Sky Sports, carries a warning before the show begins with a voiceover stating, quote, "The following is a post-watershed production. It is unsuitable for children, and some scenes may be unacceptable to adult viewers." What are my opinions on that? Well, I don't really have an opinion on that. Different countries will air different warnings before the show. WWE here in the U.S. used to have a warning before Raw. Warning viewers. So it all depends. I actually agree, quite frankly, that there are scenes in the show that are unacceptable to adult viewers. I myself find myself offended by some of the bullshit they put on TV sometimes. So maybe that's what they mean by that. Somebody asked me in a question during the week about what would be my Survivor Series dream team if I could pick one. This was based on a promotional feature on WWE.com that had the wrestlers picking their own Survivor Series dream teams. If you could pick any wrestler from the past, WWF wrestler from the past, what sort of four or five man team would you put together? And, my dream team, quite frankly, would consist of Bret Hart, Owen Hart, Chris Benoit, Kurt Angle, and Brock Lesnar. I mean, seriously, who could beat them? Who could possibly beat that team in a shoot or a work? I mean, the wrestling would be off the charts, and just for kicks, I'd probably put them in there against, Triple H, John Cena, and Hornswoggle. How's that for a Survivor Series match? Let's see here. Dear Solomonster, could you possibly tell me why, oh why, in the history of wrestling, cage matches always have an escape through the door option? Why? It is the most nonsensical rule in all of wrestling. Why would anyone climb when they can walk out? Well, the first answer to you, to your question, why is there a door? Fat people. That's why. Big fat guys have a tough time sometimes climbing 15 feet out and over the cage. That's why there's a door. Of course, you have fat people who can't even fit through the door, but that's a different story. Some, of course, all the cage matches now also have the option of pinfall and submission, so having a door is really kind of pointless. It adds to the drama of a match. Whenever somebody lunges at the door, you know, and tries to escape, it's all about emotion. It's all about, you know, drawing people in. Is he going to be able to escape? You know, that's really what it is. I mean, wrestling is all about eliciting emotion out of people. It's just another way to, you know, to accomplish that. And the argument would be that most people don't go through the door because they want to climb out. They don't want to take the easy way out. Of course, it's ridiculous. If you or I were in a cage match for a championship, I'd lunge at that door first opportunity I had. I don't give a shit if I entertain the fans or not. I want to win. So, yes, it is nonsensical, but there you go. Paul wrote into the show during Raw last Monday night. He was playing the Noah Mark Raw drinking game that I plugged last week. And Paul wrote in to tell me that he was playing the drinking game I mentioned on the podcast. It was the third commercial break so far, and he had already downed half a fucking bottle of Jack Daniels, and I have not heard from him since. So, rest in peace, Paul. God, I think that might be the first sound off death. Anyway, that's it. That's all I got. I'm going to cinch up the mailbag here. My voice can take no more. I got to rest up. TheSoloMonster@gmail.com is the email address. TheSoloMonster@gmail.com, all one word. Find me on Twitter, twitter.com/SoloMonster. We're now over 350 followers. I want to get that number up to 400. It's my new goal. So tell your friends, tell everybody at school or at work to not just follow the Sound Off page, but actually follow it. Click the follow button. Join Twitter. It's free. It costs you 2 minutes of your time, and it is well worth it. You can not only follow me, you can follow a lot of wrestling personalities on Twitter as well. Kevin Nash is now on Twitter. Chris Jericho has been on Twitter, and he's just phenomenally funny to follow. Dixie Carter is on Twitter. Eric Bischoff. These are the legitimate people, and most of them you can find on my page. There are people that I follow, so just find them there if you want to. But do log on there. And, of course, as always, you can download the Sound Off free through the iTunes Music Store. You can subscribe to the show and have it automatically delivered to you whenever a new show is posted. Just like that. It's the magic of technology for you. So, that's going to do it. On that note, Sound Off 90 is in the books. We now head to episode 91. It will likely be next weekend. I say likely because I'm not sure right now. We're headed into a holiday week here, the Thanksgiving holiday coming up here in the States. And those of you, of course, who are celebrating Thanksgiving, do have a happy, healthy, and safe holiday. I know I am thankful to have all of you listening to my podcast each and every week now for over 2 years running. Really do appreciate that. I'm headed to Atlantic City, the site of WrestleMania's 4 and 5 this Friday for a wedding for one of my friends, and I'll be back sometime on Saturday. But, you know, so this trip, it kind of, you know, me being gone for a day and a half wreaks a little bit of chaos with my schedule. I have to juggle a couple of things, so I should be able to do a show next weekend. And quite frankly, you know, maybe even a little earlier than that. I make no guarantees, but we'll see. We'll see what the future brings us. And that's going to do it. So until next time, be well, stay safe, have a happy Thanksgiving, enjoy the Survivor Series, and we'll see you right back here soon on SEScoops.com.
You've been listening to The Sala Monster.
You know, I really just don't understand what they're doing.
Anybody agree with me out there? I mean, anybody. Come on, throw me a bone here.
Probably the single dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
God, I love this business.
On SEScoops.com.